Yeah, having my head shoved into the steps of the Ulster Bank in Ranelagh, cold butt of a gun put into the back of your skull. That's a moment where you go, okay, yeah, I think this one's up.
How does a high-flying academic become one of Ireland's most prolific bank robbers?
What I would see as the most important part of this still lies open.
I'm Not Here to Hurt You, a brand new series from the award-winning team behind the Indo Daily.
That November day, that's where it all begins.
Out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Seachtain, an Indo as Gaeilge.
Time I mon iarracht I aon of chacht ar a chur, agus suilgam a machan seo, gur féidir é a chur in uig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltí, fís, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhéadach ara I gcuirna meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gináim go raibh orthchar na reachtam. Iadach sé tarann go raibh an orthchar san I lis dúthail agus gimine fnacht gór a chlig sár ducha sin éachar. Ná ní bhín ann dár dárach sin, bhín marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Hello and you're welcome to The Big Tech Show with me, Adrian Weckler, the tech editor of The Irish and Sunday Independent. And this week we're going to talk about media in a digital landscape. We had a very interesting podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I've got some really interesting guests who I think will probably explain quite a lot today. Adrian Costa is the chief executive of Journal Media, publishes the journal.ie and a few of the titles online. Anne O'Dea is the chief executive and co-founder of Silicon Republic, and also the founder of InspireFest, which I think Anne is now Future Human.
That's right. Yeah, we relaunched and had to move it from May to October. It's now Future Human.
Okay, well, it's on. Well, we'll come to that actually in a few minutes. By the way, you're both very welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining today. We're going to talk a little bit about how media is doing in a digital age, maybe some of the future opportunities, challenges, things like relationships with big tech companies. I want to just briefly ask you at the moment, from your own point of view, how do you sum up the health of the media at the moment?
I mean, it's an enormous question, but I suppose, COVID clearly had a big effect on a lot of people. I think a lot of the, and you'd be able to answer this probably better yourself, Adrian, as regards to newspapers, but for a lot of the mass media, a lot of people we were talking about had huge hits to their, to their revenues, basically. I mean, people who rely on sort of consumer brands, some of the people I know personally were telling me they could be down by 75, 90% sometimes in their revenue. So big hit to people. I know it's only short term. Us ourselves, because we're very much a niche publication in Silicon Republic, and because it's science and technology and innovation, I suppose the brands that advertise and work with us were less hit, but we still saw a hit, like, without a question. So there's a short-term issue for a lot of publishers, and I think the publishers that were in a weak position to start with are probably in big trouble now. I think the more resilient ones who have a loyal readership will, they'll work their way through it. But, I mean, that's a short-term issue. On the larger landscape, I mean, where do I start? How long is a piece of string? I think the famous quote about the French Revolution is it's too soon to tell.
Yeah. We'll get into some of those issues maybe later on. Adrian, how would you sum things up at the moment?
I kind of agree. I think what's interesting is over the last couple of decades, probably, what we've been seeing is a change of consumption of media. And with that comes a flux in business models, in norms, in processes, that inevitably creates challenges and opportunities. And then when you layer on top a crisis like this, a health crisis, an economic crisis, that's going to accelerate a lot of the processes that we're going through, and it's going to throw new challenges on top. So it's very hard to kind of sit down and say, oh yeah, our health is like this. It's you know, some days I feel like, look, you know, this we're going to come the other side way more resilient, and that's a good thing. But some days you're thrown, you know, some challenges that you go like, well, this one I wasn't expecting. Like, for example, what's currently happening now. If on the return to some kind of normality, we see a huge shift of the trends that we've been seeing, particularly around advertising, and nothing to compensate for that, to balance that, well, there's going to be a lot of casualties. While, you know, if suddenly people realize that through this, that perhaps the value of having a vibrant news media industry is extremely valuable, well, maybe, you know, maybe we come the other side way better than we could ever possibly be. So,
well, I was going to come to that later on. I mean, I had a whole thing here ready to talk about trust. But look, seeing as you kind of raised the issue, the issue of how we all pay for our journalism and our organizations, there are a few medium to long-term trends that seem apparent. And then there's what's happened with the pandemic. I suppose the ad funding model is the one that a lot of us in the media have focused on and have been hit by. Do we think now that the ad funding model is kind of mortally wounded?
I don't. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. I mean, there's huge challenges in that the ad funding model as it currently stands. And I mean, it's, you know, I think was it the IABS who are the UK advertising body did some research there with PwC recently, and they found, for example, in programmatic advertising, that about 50% of what advertisers were paying was actually reaching the publishers. You know, then it was the rest of it was falling in the obvious gaps. I mean, that's not sustainable. So, I mean, any publisher that relies uniquely on programmatic advertising, I think, is going to have big challenges in the coming days. We, for example, at Silicon Republic, never went down that route. And I think people thought we were slightly daft at the time, but we retained that idea. It's easier for us because we're in niche publishing. But that idea of contextual advertising and placement, and not giving that power to a third party. I just think publishers are going to have to start looking at how much power they have given. And I know you'll probably talk about this, Adrian, how much power they've given third parties, you know, with whether they've given the data to the third parties, whether they're given their reader data. Like, I mean, there are publishers, and Facebook and Google know their readers better than the publishers know them. You know, to me, that's all going to have to change hugely. In a niche publication like us, we kind of live and breathe our community. And I think that's where the big social media companies can be very powerful in helping you build your community. But anybody who's relying on the big tech publishers, I know they call themselves not publishers, but let's face it, they're taking about 95% of the advertising revenues. I think over-reliance on them is going to change hugely for the publishers who survive and are sustainable. That's just my own personal view.
I mean, it doesn't look like that we can name the two of them, really. It's Facebook and Google and Instagram and YouTube and their component parts. It doesn't look like they're going anywhere. They look like they're here for the medium to long term. With that being the case, all of us, the three of our media organizations, do rely to quite an extent on advertising revenue to fund things. Given that they are not going away, do we think that that portion of our business that was funded by advertising is, and I'm going to ask the question, is it mortally wounded? Adrian, do you have a view on that?
Yeah, I don't think it's mortally wounded. I think, you know, the trend that we've been seeing in the last 2 years has been that of digital advertising growing, but growing for Google, Facebook as companies. I would argue Amazon is another one that we should mention there as well. More in a global context, perhaps not so much in Ireland. But their share grew more than the actual overall growth of digital advertising. So they were eating the shares of the publishers like ourselves, like yourselves, and so on and so forth. I think that is likely to continue, but I also think that there is room for advertising in news publishing, and I think that that's not going to disappear. It may be that you are not 100% advertising funded. I think that is completely unlikely. But the same way that if you look at the traditional newspaper business pre-digital era, it wasn't only circulation funded or only advertising funded. There were only a few of those.
Yeah, it was a mix. Reader offers, go on this cruise. Here's a stair lift. Here's something to help you get out of the bath. The Telegraph's my favorite on the Saturday. These ads help you get out of the bath. How many people need to get out of the bath? Well, actually, to be fair, there are actually people who need to get out of the bath. But yeah, I take your point. It's a mixture of funding models.
So I don't think we can kind of catch the label and say, okay, that's dead. What's next? What do we do next? I think we need to look at, well, what's our position? Clearly, the value proposition of Google and Facebook in advertising is a very compelling value proposition, and they're showing that by capturing market share. But we also have a value proposition, one that is different. And what we need to do is we need to find the use case for that and get the right amount of funds for that particular product.
I mean, one of the things that I think within the broader media industry gave quite a lot of people a lot of hope was The Guardian. So The Guardian, to its critics, was held up as a basket case financially for not having charged or asked for not having charged a subscription, introduced this idea of a kind of a reader club payment model, and then in 2018 broke even, actually wiped out its losses. I think both of your organizations, certainly Adrian, I think the Journal has, when I go onto the Journal now, I've donated to it.
Thank you.
Yeah. And it wasn't that much. It wasn't that much, but it was just in recognition of the fact that I sometimes read it. So you have that now front and in center. I assume partially inspired by what The Guardian and others have done there. How is that working out for you?
So the whole idea, we think about it as readers' revenue. And the whole idea of readers' revenue is something that we've been thinking about for a number of years. And that manifested in a couple of different ways. It manifested with launching a sort of crowdsourcing and crowdfunding website for investigations called Noteworthy. Is one of the things that we do. There was another, it also manifested in the form of a membership for our sports publication, The 42. And the last thing we did was launch what we call a reader's appeal, which we only launched 2 months ago for the Journal. And while we were always thinking and considering, how do we, can we ask readers for direct funding while keeping our news available to everybody, which was the premise that we want to try and keep for as long as we can. We weren't expecting to do it this quickly. We were expecting to do it at a later stage. We were expecting to do it maybe a year down the line, something like that. And then when the collapse in advertising happened, the way it happened, it was clear to us that maybe we should just accelerate it and just get it out there. So. Very quickly, we turned around. We got it out 2 months ago, and we got over 5,000 contributors within those 2 months. So we were at a bit over 5,000 at the moment, which to me is a really good result, and it's a testament that there are plenty of people that value not just the work we do, but also news in general. The Guardian has a way more complex and complicated model than that. You could call it a source of inspiration, of course, very aware of the work they do. And I think in many respects, it's excellent. But there are also lots of other news companies around the globe that create membership style type of models for their business. That helps them keep their content free, basically.
Go on.
I was just going to say, what happened to us is people were reaching out to us and saying, look, we've been reading it for years for free. Can we help
So we did launch a little tip jar. You may not have even noticed it on the site. It's not very prominent. I think it's
I will say it's not prominent on the site because I did actually go looking for it and I couldn't find it.
Yeah, well, there you go. So it is very much targeted at people who read this every day, all day. So they see it regularly and people were very decent. I mean, I'll be honest with you, it was a kind of a trial and error, a bit like the journal. You know, we've looked at all the models over the years, membership, you name it. But that was as much about a little bit of cash flow as anything else. So like we found that, I mean, we could see that like the people who were donating were people who've been reading us for years and who know us and love what we do. So they were trying to give us a little bit of a boost. It's not something that we see as sustainable in the long term. Like I think Mother Jones model is very good. It's very sustainable for them because of the type of journalism they do. You know, it's kind of public interest journalism that people are willing to pay for. Sorry, not unlike the journal, by the way, and some of the amazing work they did during COVID. Really impressive. So I think that was one of the reasons people contributed to the journal as well. I did myself also, by the way, you'd be glad to know.
One off or subscriber?
Two.
I admit I was one off.
I was one off. I have to confess, I was okay. One off as well. Absolutely. But, you know, for the same reasons. I think that's an interesting thing that you were talking about in The Guardian. The Guardian is a really interesting example for all the reasons you said, Adrian. But the other thing that The Guardian has really cottoned onto is the value of data. And I do think that when we're looking at models in the future, whether people are talking about membership or, you know, subscription or whatever, one of the things that The Guardian is very much looking at is that in order to get this, you need to give us your information. So data as a currency, you know, rather than a physical payment. I think that's something you're going to see in the coming years quite a lot, because a lot of people are very happy to give up a minimal amount of data for content.
Well, I was going to say that there would be some irony there if it was The Guardian that was spearheading that, given that The Guardian really is at the vanguard of going after Facebook in particular for their particular, how they manipulate data profitably and legally, usually, themselves.
The Guardian's model is exactly that, though, is to do it, you know, legally and transparently. I mean, there's a whole generation coming up that are very happy to share a minimal amount of data once they know exactly what it's being used for. And I think somebody like The Guardian would have, you know, there's a huge issue of trust. You mentioned the word trust early on, Adrian. I think they would have, you know, a community that trusts them very much and would probably trust them with their data for the very reason that you say there, you know, that they go after the people who misuse data.
No, I think that's a massive point of difference. I think The Guardian are extremely transparent about why they're asking you for that data. And Facebook, I don't think is as transparent in that regard. Also, they had a few big boos that nobody else had. And The Guardian, I suppose, one of the things that The Guardian has that that most companies, perhaps in Ireland, wouldn't have is the size of product and technology team, product and development team. I mean, to pull those things off properly, you need to have a very, very sizable technology team.
Yeah, one of the things, for what it's worth, one of the things I think that the journal did really well, especially when it started, it was the first media company as a new entrant to really take the engineering and the construction of the app really seriously. And my own view as to why you ended up seeing an awful lot of people on the bus with the journal app open, especially in those early years, I would argue the Indo app is probably at least as read now, but in those years was because of that focus on engineering and tech in terms of the actual digital infrastructure. You were kind of ahead of the game there.
I think we were, the timing was right. So we came out in October 2010 was when we launched. And it was in December 2010 when we launched our app. And the reason why to do the journal was very much because it was very hard to get news online in the way that we thought you should get them. And one of the ways you should get them is for consumption on your mobile phone. I mean, it was early days of the smartphone, and I think the iPhone had been in Ireland for 2 or 3 years only. But, you know, it was gaining momentum fast. There weren't that many apps there. So it was a good focus to drive adoption. And I do agree, I think that really helped us certainly gain traction with readers.
Yeah, whereas Anne, with Silicon, I always felt that one of its strengths was its ability to move quickly on things like conferencing and to be able to move around the front page product of your business, which is the journalism, the Silicon Republic itself, to be able to find other models around that, which I suppose maybe led ultimately to InspireFest as well, and a kind of a conferencing business model.
Yeah, well, I mean, we would spend a lot of time, I have to confess, we often look to the US and the UK when we're looking at very, you know, sort of successful models. I'm sure the journal does exactly the same. So we examine very carefully what people are doing, what's working, what isn't. Things like Code and Recode would have caught our eye early on.
So
we always felt that really to be a publisher in science and technology, you had to have an experiential side as well. Now, I mean, we do some podcasts with Future Human, you know, you can do, you know, we used to do small breakfast events, executive events and that, but we felt we needed one annual flagship event. Now, we're not talking 70,000 people here, and we never aimed to do that. The idea was always that it would be sort of a 3,000 person event that would bring together, we actually had people from 52 countries last year. So it's small, but international, which was always very much the idea. And we found that that fed into the publishing and that publishing fed into the event. So, I mean, the biggest compliment we would get about the events is that the content is the best that people see anywhere.
Go on, continue.
I was going to say, sorry, there are other events that are bigger on the networking and all the rest of it, but as publishers, we're pretty damn good at curating content and knowing who should be talking to who and that sort of thing.
Well, also, one of the things that I felt that you did, whether or not, I'm not sure if this was a deliberate strategy or not, but it certainly worked, was that InspireFest went out of its way to have as many prominent female speakers, for example, as male speakers. It was kind of unusual. Still stands out for that. You'll get quite close to a 50-50 or even more.
It was very conscious. My co-founder are male and female for a start, so we bring that point of view. But the idea, for example, the last 5 years, InspireFest has had over 50% women speakers and 30% people of color, or, you know, BAME. Which that was really important to us as well, because one of the things we felt responsibility as publishers really was to try and kind of change our industry a little bit. And our industry was incredibly white and male and straight.
Still is. I'm not sure. I go to a lot of the conferences, you know, during the year, and you can kind of tell if you were just blindfolded and walked into one, judging by the crowds that are walking by you and the backpacks, you can kind of tell what conference you're at. And to be fair to the Web Summit and to be fair to those kind of conferences, they are much more diverse now. They certainly have a lot more women attending than some of the others. Whereas if you drop into, I've been to, Microsoft, your conference. I mean, you drop into a Microsoft conference, I'd say it's probably 80 to 90% blokes. And at that, 40% blokes with backpacks walking along with some sort of Tolkien themed t-shirt, right? I'm constructing a stereotype there. I'm being a bit facetious. I'd say things like IBM are probably the same. Anyway, sorry, I'm off on a tangent there on gender stereotypes conference. Adrian, do you think, kind of going into the future, that what you've achieved now in trying to diversify a kind of a commercial model with membership style thing, do you think that will play a bigger part going forward?
Certainly. I mean, I think it's something that we started very recently. Like with the 42, we started less than a year ago. With Noteworthy, we started a little bit over a year ago. But both are creating ways for the audience to make a direct payment in lieu of something. So I expect the growth will come from there, much more than coming from advertising, where, you know, it's going to be under pressure. But advertising, it's a requirement, I think, to not just for us, for other news organizations too.
We introduced a paywall in February, so we're 3-4 months into it now. By the way, we've well over 20,000 subscribers now, which surprised me. I mean, it was probably surprised a lot of people, but one of the balances that we still have, because we have an awful lot of people coming to the website, so one of the balances we still have is a mix between premium or paywall content and non-paywall content, essentially to support an advertising model. But the way that the advertising market looks like it's going over the next couple of years, I mean, I don't know because I'm not in advertising, but just looking at it from sort of adjacent to that, I would worry about you know, hooking too much into the online ad model. But you might tell me that there are different trends.
No, I mean, advertising is under pressure, and I mean, even more under pressure with the current situation. I think advertising will continue to grow in digital, but the share of Google, Facebook, Amazon, etc., will continue to grow too. Yeah. So the question is, what's left there? How much is that, and how is that distributed? I think potentially radio, TV are also going to be under pressure.
Oh, I mean, they are. It's not going to be. They definitely are.
I mean, even post-COVID, you know, like I think the share is coming from somewhere. It's coming from that. So unless advertising overall starts growing more than the speed by which the three or four giants are growing, well, then everybody will be under pressure. We're going to have to reconsider how to deal with that. Mm. And there is the matter of intermediaries as well that Anne was referring to, that is unclear how much value they add, and it's only starting to be clear how much value they take away.
One thing we forgot to mention as well here, in a way, is the advertisers. You know, the advertisers need to reach people. They need to reach the right people. The brands, the kind of brands that we work with, for example, they tend to be kind of Fortune 500 or kind of blue chip brands because it's science and technology for, you know, obvious reasons. They don't actually want to be sitting beside content that's not trustworthy necessarily. It's not good for them. I mean, I won't even start on some of the things that have been on Facebook recently. One of the fact checkers is Daily Caller. Like, I mean, I rest my case. But there's a real argument that the advertisers are going to be looking, their dollars are going to be chasing good content and good publications. So I think for specialist publications, for example, and niche publications, and I think you mentioned this in your last podcast as well, I think there's a real opportunity there with like innovative products that go way beyond just text and video. To actually grab those advertising dollars. So I am optimistic by nature, but I'm quite optimistic about my sector, I have to confess.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, because this podcast, it tends to be sponsored about maybe a third of the year, but one of the more recent sponsors we had, I won't say which one, came on for a 6-week sponsorship period. But the reason they came on was not because we were reaching 100,000 people, because we're not reaching 100,000 people. But they came on because they're trying to recruit. And it was a sort of a crossover tech engineering recruitment drive. And they literally sponsored this podcast because they figured that there would be, you know, 3,000-4,000 people literally who might be in the zone of they're trying to recruit. When I found out why they were sponsoring the podcast, it was very interesting to me.
It's reaching the right people. You know, that's a big challenge for them as well, because, you know, that scattergun approach is not that terribly effective, you know. So I think the podcast example is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also what the surroundings of that advertising mean to the people consuming it. So in other words, you can probably reach the right people with the micro-targeting that you get on Facebook. But, you know, the surroundings are not quite under your control. Like you don't have certainty that you're not going to see a horror show right next to your brand. So I think that's a point of weakness. And I think perhaps that's a strength of actual publishing, which platforms like social media wouldn't have.
What do we all think of this potential new government media? And the government's always makes noises about some down the line we might create a fund, you know, some sort of new public fund, maybe to be alongside the license fee, maybe to replace the license fee, but to bring in more players. And I'm always slightly skeptical of how that would work, who would be included, how the funds would be distributed. What do we have any views about whether this would be a good or a bad thing? Might it just be a kind of a stitch up for traditional media players? We would probably benefit if it was. Do you have any thoughts either way on any of that stuff?
I think public sector broadcasting and publishing is absolutely crucial. So, I mean, I'd really like to see any kind of fund like that managed really incredibly well and directed in the right places. I suspect publications like ours, we don't tend to benefit from funds like that. You know, it would tend to go towards more general.
Why wouldn't you make an argument for that? And I'm just...
I'd be very good at making an argument for it, but I just know from history we're seen as being very independent and well able to look after ourselves. And you know, tech and science news isn't a public service. That is the impression that's out there, and I guarantee you we would struggle to get anything out of it. That doesn't bother me, frankly, because maybe we can look after ourselves. The thing that worries me is general media and it all going behind a paywall, for example. That's very worrying. Like, I mean, I really would like to think that there'd be a BBC and an RTE, for example, in broadcast publishing that would be supported. So,
well, I mean, the RTE, the license fee, which I pay every year, and I agree with you, I support it. That is a paywall. I mean, that's a subscription. I'm paying 160 euro. I'm paying like whatever, 13 euro per month for access to RTE. I don't. Nobody's forcing me to pay, but I do pay. That is a paywall.
Yeah, it is, but it's a paywall for a public service, though. And I mean, you can criticize RTE, you know, over lots of things. But that said, it is the nearest thing we have to like the BBC in Ireland. And I mean, I certainly don't want to lose it. And I think the society would be poorer for losing broadcasters like that.
I agree with funding of public service content, and obviously the license fee is the way we do that here, and that goes in its majority to RTE, but not just to RTE. And the reason why I wouldn't consider it as a paywall is because, well, yes, it's true, if you have a TV, you pay it. If you don't have a TV, you can still avail of the service on radio, or you can still avail of the service online. So it's still a public service.
Very few people don't have TVs, though.
Granted, but what I'm saying is, I wouldn't consider it the same. I would consider it a tax that's directed towards public service broadcasting, and is in its vast majority gone to RTE, which also plays a role in the private market and in advertising in particular, which
big,
is more
a big part.
Of a problem.
Yeah.
I would argue that's more of a problem. Yeah.
That part is more of a problem. I agree.
But then when we talk about, okay, what's the government, obviously the whole thing is quite outdated. It's clear that it has problems. There's been loads of talk about how it's going to be reformed, et cetera, et cetera. Consultations, so on and so forth. And now there is a new plan that I welcome. I think it's important that we have some kind of focus. And I think the newspapers have been asking for it for years and so on and so forth. So that's possible. I think there is some kind of source of an example when we look at the Sound Ambition, for example, fund that the Broadcasting Authority has. I see that as a pot of funding that is to create an ecosystem of producers that produce public service broadcasting that then gets distributed in RTE and other places. I don't see why that couldn't be extended. Not necessarily in its form, but as a model in which the funding goes directly to services that are providing what the public is paying for, which is public service.
So is that a a sophisticated way of saying that if such a thing were renegotiated or expanded, that you guys, for example, would be making your case to say, look, this is the work we do. If there is funding going for public interest style journalism reporting, we should be included.
Well, I think we should make the case. If it's something that we can provide, of course. If it's something that we cannot provide, no, it would be ridiculous. But, you know, if suddenly there is, because it's important that it's not just RTE as well, I would argue. I mean, step one, yes, we have to have some kind of public service broadcaster like RTE. I would entirely agree with that. I would feel strongly it would be better if it was entirely public funded as opposed to a mixed fund like it currently is now. Mm. I would say if that public service that it provides can also be provided by other third parties, like documentary makers, like whatever, well, why couldn't they have a bite at the funding? Why couldn't they, you know, compete for part of the funds?
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, that happens with commissions today.
Yeah.
Broadcasting.
Yeah, it does, exactly. You know, independently produced programs, so why would it not work? I like that idea of the extension of the Sound of Vision type fund, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I had a whole section ready on Trustwell because we may not have time to get through it all. Reuters brought out their digital news report recently. Mixed results. Broadly, it's medium to high in the Irish media. Trust in the news has remained stable. A survey of 2,000 people, 48% agreed they could trust most news most of the time, the same percentage as last year. We have the joint seventh highest in the 40 countries study. The international average is 38%, down 4%. In the UK, it's down to 28% from 40%. In the US, it's around the same. There is an existential question here facing a lot of us. We're talking about business models, but we often give ourselves pats on the back in terms of the quality of what we do and our importance to democracy and journalism and all that kind of stuff. And yet the trust in our profession generally, broadly, seems to be falling.
Yeah. It's a big problem. And if you break it by demographics, it's even bigger, because it's the younger generations that have the least trust.
Mm. See, I wonder, is it because we're in, you know, a deepening cesspit, you know, and we're in a sort of desperation, clickbait and all that kind of stuff, or is it because there are younger people who are maybe more enlightened, find it easier to get a more rounded picture of whatever is going on through various channels, and therefore are naturally more questioning and more skeptical of the news sources? Or is it a combination of both? Like, is the quality of news going down? And in particular, is news blurring with opinion? Or is it a more enlightened audience and population that can add more independent thought to their analysis of the news?
Yeah, enlightened might be overly kind for some people, but yeah, there's a whole enlightened bunch of people out there as well. But there's also, I think there's a huge kind of misunderstanding as well. Like a lot of people, of young people I know, we say nephews and nieces and all the rest of it, they think that they're getting their content from social. But then I'll ask them, you know, what article were they reading or whatever. And in fact, they're on, for example, Twitter, and they're reading a piece from the New York Times, and they're reading a piece from the Irish Independent, from the Journal, from Silicon Republic. And they think that they're getting their news from social, and they think that's much more reliable because they're curating their news feed themselves, if that makes sense. I'm not absolutely convinced that this generation coming up don't trust the media.
Hmm. I was referring to the actual responses in the survey, the response in the survey, the demographics with a higher degree of trust, if I remember correctly, were the all
that's
the
right.
Demographic.
Yeah.
I think that to kind of even chip at this question, you need to kind of break down what we refer to when we talk about trust. Or, you know, how are the respondents interpreting what's trust to them? And you know, we probably rightly look at, well, look, we're providing quality content. Why wouldn't you trust it? Why wouldn't you trust that? And I think one of the key reasons why perhaps that's not trusted is because maybe it doesn't represent these consumers very well. As in, maybe the level of representation is too low. As in, if the question was, do you feel represented by what you read in the news, what's a leading indicator of trust, you know, maybe we can start there. Then maybe we can start to create more representation in the type of news that we present, and that will help us drive trust. That's one of the hypotheses that we look at, and that's one of the ways that we think about trust in the journal and the other type.
I do wonder whether there is an issue between a relationship between polarization generally of political and cultural opinion and consequent ire sort of fired toward media sources. I mean, and you mentioned BBC earlier on and RTE. And it astonished me the level of invective that was aimed toward the BBC during the general election. It absolutely astonished me. And from both sides of the political spectrum, both sides were convinced that the BBC's decision-making or the BBC's curation of the news events represented a sellout to the other side. And I think that's what's behind some of the fall in the UK, people saying they don't trust the news, because their pals, their political pals have told them that the centre ground is a sellout to the other side.
Yeah. I would agree, UK and America, both.
Yeah.
Yeah, in America, it's arguably even worse. I mean, but it was one stat from the Reuters report which fascinated me was that in the UK, the it has plunged most among news users who lean to the political left, right, to Guardian readers basically, whereas in our Guardian readers assessing the BBC, whereas in the US it has plunged most in right wing people. So that's Trump's acolytes when Trump goes on about the media being the enemy and fake news, and his believers now think that NBC and CBS and ABC, the mainstream center, and the New York Times to an extent, are all sort of untrustworthy.
Libs, yeah. They describe MSNBC as libs, like all of the Trump
reporters. We get it here. I mean, to a much lesser extent. We're not as polarized at all as the UK or the US, but we get it here. I mean, colleagues of mine in the Irish Times, I see the Irish Times, for example, they get it more than we do. They get it in the neck from people on both sides who claim that the Irish Times is now just a right-wing haven, or on the other side, the Irish Times is just for Marxist communists who want everybody to have an abortion, you know? I mean, it's, do you know what I mean? And RTE now as well.
I mean, getting it from both sides, I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily. Like we would have done surveys of our users over years and each time when they send you feedback in these surveys and the feedback, why are you so this or why are you so that? And it feels bad, obviously, you don't like it, and you say, but I'm not. But when that feedback says the opposite things, you must be doing something right.
But you must be doing something right. And that has always comforted us. But what I'm saying is that it looks like from this Reuters digital report, that sense of comfort, of centrist comfort, that we must be navigating a decent way through, that ground is getting smaller, and the polarized bits on the side are getting bigger and squeezing in, and they're the ones who are saying they don't trust the news.
But that's a much bigger discussion. Do you want to do another podcast?
No. I know it's a much...
I mean, you're talking about the political and societal position at the moment, which is being reflected then in that kind of research. I mean, I'd like to see that research over the next couple of years. You know, it's a one-off report. I'm not utterly convinced that you know, any survey is wide enough to at the moment to capture that bizarre mess that is out there and that bizarre level of polarization. And as to the other Adrian, I couldn't agree more. You know, when you're getting it from both sides, you're probably doing something right, and it's probably a really good sign, with the great exception of Bolton, I think.
that global context certainly undermines the local context of trust as well.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Hmm.
Look, we could go on and talk a lot more about this, but thank you very much, both of you, for your time. Adrian Costa, CEO of Journal Media, Anne O'Dea, CEO and co-founder of Silicon Republic. Very, very interesting discussion on the present and the future of the media. And that's all we have time for this week. So for me, Adrian Wechter, the tech editor of the Irish, the sellout Irish Independent and the right-wing and left-wing Sunday Independent. That's all we have time for this week. I'll see you same time next week. Bye-bye.